All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 22nd day of May, 2018. Before I talk more about today's show, let me remind you that I am the editor of Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and that you can subscribe to my letter by going to miningstocks.com, or call our office during normal work hours in New York City at 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. Would also like to encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's excellent newsletter by going to chenpicks.com. Chen is an occasional occasional guest on this show and provides some very interesting ideas, especially in the area of biotech and energy. Also follows some of the mining stocks, so we'll have Chen on from time to time. But chenpicks.com is where you should go to learn more about what he does and to sign up for his letter. I want to thank each of you for listening to the show, making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel, and also to encourage you to send along your questions, criticisms, praises, or whatever comments you have to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. We do want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Our sponsors for today's show: RN Resources, Balmoral Resources, Bonterra Resources, Genesis Metals Corp., Klondike Gold, Northern Empire, and Novo Resources. Well, you should know that our sponsors are really only by invitation. It isn't enough for companies to simply have the money and want to come on as sponsors so they can tell you their stories, but these are companies that I have, in every case, have invested my own personal money in, but also have covered them in my newsletter, Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. So they're companies that I really like, have a good feeling for, and that's why they are here as sponsors. Should say much the same modus operandi is applied to the Metals Investor Forum, where the companies that are there only by invitation of the newsletter writers. Now, the Metals Investor Forum, I'll be getting on an airplane tomorrow morning to attend that event in Vancouver on May 23rd and 24th. If I got that right, the 24th and 25th, I'm sorry, of this month. So I'm heading out there tomorrow morning. Actually, I'm told it's 95% sold out. I did check a minute ago before coming on the show. There are still a few seats available. But if you're in the Vancouver area and can attend this and are interested in these companies, I would strongly suggest you go to jtaylormedia.com, jtaylormedia.com, click on the Metals Investor Forum banner and just simply put in your email and name, and you will be assured a seat at the Metals Investor Forum at the Georgia Hotel in Vancouver. The seats, it's a free event, but as I say, the seats are limited. They do provide a lunch and a breakfast for all the attendees. There's an open bar after the conference closes on Friday and Saturday. I'll be speaking at 11:30 on Friday. The title of my talk will be 2018, A Year of Epic Market Disruptions? And part two. I suggested that would be the case in my speech up there in January. And we will see. I mean, the equity market continues to do okay. We're going to be talking more to our guests today about that and where they think this market is going, where various markets are going. I will be examining in my speech, I'll be talking really along the lines of what Alistair MacLeod has talked about here, having to do with the with the credit cycle. It's not a business cycle, really. It's a credit cycle. Activities and markets are driven by money creation, not by the natural ebbs and flows of nature, but rather by the manipulation of those natural flows by primarily by the Federal Reserve, central banks, and also, of course, governments that stimulate and I would argue create a great deal of damage long term by their actions. But in any event, I'm going to be talking about where I think we are now in the in this credit cycle, and in fact, that's some of what I'm going to be talking to our two guests about in a few minutes from now today as well. Also sharing the stage with me in Vancouver will be the four companies that I have invited to this event. Klondike Gold Corp, they are a sponsor of this show. They have the massive gold target, some 55-kilometer strike length of favorable structure and evidence of gold along the way. We've had Peter Talman on this show in the past, not too long ago, to talk about it. He'll be back again, but he'll be on the stage with me to provide an update to the attendees there on Klondike Gold Corp. Balmoral Resources is another company I've invited there. They'll be sharing the stage with me. They are a sponsor to this show as well. They have a very sizable nickel deposit that I think is grossly undervalued as far as the market price of the company goes, but they are also outlining a very sizable gold project. Actually, have some high-grade near-surface resources that have been delineated just recently that I think are very impressive, although the market doesn't seem to be paying much attention, as is the case with almost all the junior mining companies these days. The market the gold shares are very much out of favor, and I would suggest very strongly, in light of what we're going to be talking about the rest of today's show, that now might be a really good time to take a serious look at a lot of these companies. Another company that will be sharing the stage with me in Vancouver is Telson Resources. They have been a sponsor in this show in the past. That's a company that stock chart looks pretty good. It's looking pretty good because they are actually in the process of building and restoring and putting back into production two mining projects in Mexico. And they're doing very, very well with those projects. They are actually, before they've gone to commercial production, they are generating some cash flows from bulk samples that they've been mining, bulk mining that they've been doing. But expect to go into commercial production, I believe, next quarter for one, or at least by the end of the year. No, I think next quarter for the one mine and then at the end of the year for the other. So doing very well, Telson Resources. And last but not least, Skeena Resources. It's a company that I've really come to appreciate. They are in the process of putting back into production, or at least exploring and developing, the very high-grade Snip gold deposit in the Golden Triangle of British Columbia. And this is a project that was mining incredibly high grades of gold in the past. The issues that they had, though, when the price of gold went to $200 and some, they were actually mining something like 14 grams or 12 grams per ton cutoff grades. Incredibly high-grade resource still remains there, but now, in addition to the fact that the price of gold is around $1,300, they also have infrastructure advantages, electric power that goes to the site, and roads and highways that can get access roads that get you right to the site. So Skeena Resources is another company that I like a whole lot, and I've invited them also to the Metals Investor Forum. Now, again, seats are limited. It's free, but go to jtaylormedia.com to make sure that there's a place for you if you can make this event. And I would love to see you. And if you're a listener to this show, please make sure you let me know when we rub shoulders there. As far as news for the sponsors in this show goes, Novo Resources is expected to report assays from its first bulk sample from its Comet Well project in Australia. Now, this is something the market is obviously looking forward to. The stock's been trading very, very well. I'm exceptionally pleased with that. Of course, if there should be disappointing results, we could expect the stock to drop. But, well, time will tell. I mean, this is one of the most exciting, one of the most unusual gold deposits that I have ever come in contact with, and I've been following the junior sector since 1981, just to give you an idea of how long I've been at this. This is potentially the next Witwaters Rand deposit, and as Dr. Henning said on this show, when I asked him, how could the market be pricing your shares so high, he said, well, he thinks that people want to have a chance to profit from this if things work out as he believes they can. I'm not going to say that he believes they will, because I think nobody knows for sure until more work is done, but it is a very, very exciting story. And then Northern Empire, I should mention Michael Allen will be on this show next week. He's the CEO of that company. And this is a project that I actually went out to visit a couple of months back in Southern Nevada. They are in the process, I think, of outlining what could be an enormous gold deposit. They are next to Corvus, which is really outlining some very high-grade material, but also Northern Empire has had some very, very strong assays along over a sizable strike and various targets that they are looking at on their project in Southern Nevada. So this is another story that I'm extremely excited about. Of course, I personally own both of those stocks as well. I've titled today's show, Are We Entering a Secular Bear Market in U.S. Treasuries? David McIlvenny and Michael Oliver will return. A massive defiance of nature's markets has been underway thanks in large part to the big lies of Keynesian economic theory. Keynes suggested that saving isn't important and that governments and their central banks can simply print wealth. They can print money and create wealth. That theory was tested in spades ever since the 1930s, but after 2008 and 2009, it was really tested in spades. And that took the world to that experience in 2008-2009, which was a buildup of Keynesian economics, took the world to the edge of financial destruction, total destruction financially. I mean, it was really a frightening time, if those of you can think back a few years. Yes, over a few years, we tend to forget how difficult things were. But if you go back and revisit history, you'll recall. Now, banks are starting to lend now. Again, they've forgotten. Central banks are recognizing now, however, the need to reverse course and pull money out of the economy by selling their treasuries back into the market. In other words, the Fed is downsizing its balance sheet. Keynesian economics were tried in the 1930s, as I said, for the first time in American history. Didn't work out very well. The Depression drug on for about 10 years until World War II came along, but never did the proponents of Keynesian economics ever suggest that there was a problem with Keynesian theory. Instead, people like Ben Bernanke and virtually every economist with a PhD behind his or her name suggested that policy was simply not executed properly or insufficiently. It wasn't enough dosage of money pumped into the system to make it work. And so, after 2008 and 2009, which was the most serious market crash since 1929 and the deepest recession since the 30s, a massive manipulation of the market was undertaken by the Fed and other central banks around the world on an unimaginable scale, thus setting up the next economic earthquake, which will likely be larger than the 2008-2009 episode, just as every decline has been more severe than the prior one since the 1930s. The problem is that excessive debt is never permitted by the monetary authorities to be extinguished, so that with each credit cycle, debt to income in the system grows to the point where the lifeblood of the global economy is being drained out of the system. Now, David McIlvenny will join me at the end of the second half of today's show. He will address the issues with the Federal Reserve trying to unwind the excess debt that they've created to downsize their balance sheet. We're going to explore with him what that's going to mean and how that's going to play out in light of Trump's $1.2 trillion deficit next year and another $600 billion of money that's being drained out of the system by the Fed. Who's going to save? Where is the money going to come to finance the Treasury, at least at these interest rate levels? And what will it do to the economy when interest rates rise to the levels they need to rise in order to finance the budget? Or will the Fed simply go into another massive printing episode that makes the 2008-2009 episode look like child's play? Well, we're going to talk to David about that, but also we want to ask him, how should we prepare for it? Most people don't see it. Most people are oblivious to it. The financial system and the people on Wall Street don't really want you to think about it, but we would be foolish to put our heads in the sand. I think it's always better to know the truths, even if they're unpleasant, than to ignore them so that we can prepare for the times that lie ahead. Well, as I say, David will be with me in the second half of today's show, but right now, right after our first commercial break, Michael Oliver will be with me to help us see where stocks, bonds, commodities, gold, and other markets are headed, based on Michael's work that he does, his technical work. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Michael Oliver.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again the most frequent guest on the show, Michael Oliver. And I would suggest you go to olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com, to learn more about Michael's work. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you with us, and I know that that is what our listeners believe and how they feel as well. I get a lot of very positive feedback from your presence with us, so I want to we're really grateful for your presence. Michael, let's look at the S&P 500. It's certainly, it's off its highs, for sure. I think it got close to 2,900, but if I look at a price chart, there doesn't seem to be any really serious downside threat at this stage. In fact, I see it has actually broken out above a downtrend from the peak, you know, a short-term downtrend. Mm-hmm. Applying your structural momentum readings, how are you viewing the S&P now at this point in time?
I think it's a major coil off the highs. Okay, the S&P we're talking about now, the broader market.
Yes.
Not the blow-off stuff, the Adobes, the Amazons of the world. When they come down, we'll come down like an elevator being cut. But the S&P, I think, is going to decline in layers. It's probably going to be an arduous bear market. I think we've started it. I think it's just wasting time. It's coiling, twisting, redundant price action. You could draw a line sideways through where we are right now and go back about 3 months. Mm-hmm. It's just up and down and up and down. It's great for three-day traders, but for some investors, they've got to be scratching their heads whether they're short investors or long. But I think there's enough damage been done that the asset class shift against stocks is underway, but it'll unfold in layers. It will not be an easy downturn. Most tops in the S&P are not easy. Go back and examine the 2007 and 8 top and the manner in which that bear market declined. There were savage rallies. In fact, there was one day on the way down that you rallied 100 points in one day.
Yeah.
We're talking price levels that are way below where we are now.
Yes.
So expect that. If you're a bear on stocks, don't be hyper-leveraged. Be patient. And enter in layers. Don't put it all on at once. And that's what we're focused on right now is a second layer of selling, a second place to sell. But I think the shift is underway. I think money's moving gradually out, distributing its way out of that market.
Where do you think it's going? Where's it going?
Oh, I've thought about that, and I really don't know. In other words, you could look at a price chart going back 30, 40 years and say, well, gee, the 1500s were two peaks. You know, 2000 and 2007, we're in the 1500s. So let's go back and sit on that. Well, that's a possibility, but that's a price-based one. And I frankly think that the unwinding that you've been talking about of these major, bigger-than-stock-market events, open open the possibility for something more than anybody can maybe even technically anticipate. Mm-hmm. I think the direction's changing, and it's going to be big. But there's other big things going on, too, that are probably easier to catch if you're out there to make money in terms of percent gain without as much effort. And I think that's it primarily in the commodity area.
I know you're very bullish on the commodities. Before we get to commodities, I'd like to ask you about what your view is now on the U.S. Treasuries. Have they been broken? Are you definitively broken now in your point of view?
Fully broken. I think they're set up for a counter trend rally, and I would say at least a 6-point rally at some point. We're talking T-bonds now, T-bond futures.
Yeah.
They got down to a low about 141 and change, and it wouldn't shock me if you saw 148 on a rally if the rally begins soon. There's some technical evidence that it's trying to generate that turn. But I think that turn will be coincident with a next sharp drop in stocks. In other words, a flight to safety that's brief, that helps the bonds have a counter-trend rally. But we turned major bearish on T-bonds, the long end of the debt market, in October of 2016. Price then was 166 on the T-bond futures. Right now they're laboring in the low 140s. So they've already gone a long way. We think they could go into the 120s, which would get the yields on 30 years up to 4.25.
Wow.
That's not the end of it, but that's just the next leg. But I see room for a counter-trend rally, and it might just be associated with a next sharp drop in stocks, as sometimes is, that happens.
Well, yeah, it makes competitive competition for the stock market,
A brief period of time, not a long-term divergence between them. I think they're both going down big in their long-term trends, price of bonds and price of stocks. But those little counter-trend flurries can occur when stocks get whacked.
Yeah, and keep everybody off balance, of course.
Michael,
what about the short end of the yield curve? Because it seems to me we're certainly seeing a flattening of the curve, which usually portends tougher times for the equity market as well as the economy in general. Usually pretends a recession a lot of times anyway. Do you look at the twos and the tens and things like that
really
as well?
I don't look at them that much, and I don't make a lot out of the curve. Everybody does. We don't focus on that issue that much. We're looking at the major trend direction of 10 and 30 year type maturities, both here and overseas. And we see that trend as being down in price, up in yields. Again, with the caveat that you can have counter trend rallies whenever stocks get whacked too quickly.
Right.
But no, I don't focus on the yield curve. A lot of people make big deal out of that, and they look back at various examples in the past. And I don't do that.
Okay. Well, you certainly have your own way of looking at things, which is why we love to have you here. Most people, so if we got a rising yield market, a lot interest rates are on the rise, most people figure you can't have a commodity bull market in a rising interest rate environment. You can't have gold prices rising in a rising interest rate market. You and I have lived long enough to remember a time when that happened, big time in the 1970s. But comment on that, if you would, and what are your charts?
I think it's the mid to late 70s all over again, period.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the asset classes, like the Bloomberg Commodity Index, for example, right now. I read these headlines in all the financial press on TV and so forth about, the strong dollar, which is a counter-trend rally there, by the way, and rising interest rates will keep commodities suppressed. Well, tell the Bloomberg Commodity Index that. It's taken out 2- and 3-year highs today.
Yeah.
It's up to 91.5, and I'm telling you, if you get up to, I've got specific numbers that I've told my subscribers, but about 1% above where you are now, they're going to launch it. Now, that's going to happen it's going to happen with commodities going up, not just one commodity. And frankly, I don't think it's going to be the lead, won't be oil. I think the grains will have a great say about that, and including things like sugar, cocoa, and coffee, things you don't look at normally. But the Bloomberg's making new highs, multi-year highs right now, and everybody's talking about how that can't be happening.
Yeah.
Yet it is.
Well, and oil prices too, and people talking about $4 gasoline and stuff. So the grains and agricultural commodities in general. I know you've been very bullish on those, and they're really starting to take off now. Yeah,
They're pushing out highs of the last few years. Soybeans are a bit below, but corn and wheat are pressing at last couple of years' highs. in price, and they're acting rambunctious. And there's no particular reason for that. It's not like we've got some great weather problem. I think it's just they were too low, too long, and they're starting to adjust for that. You'll probably get some kind of story to explain an upside move. There always is one. But
yeah.
We look at it technically, and we think they have the potential to be the biggest percent gainers this year among the commodities.
Well, there's lots and lots of stories when markets move, and they're just speculation more than anything a lot of times. It has nothing's measurable, but your work is measurable in the sense, and you don't care what's causing the markets to move, but you, with a highly success rate, are very accurate in giving us the direction of things, which is why we love to have you here. You commented very briefly on the dollar showing some strength, and I mean the dollar has been showing some strength, but your technical work suggests that that we're in a bear market for the dollar. It's a counter trend rally, you said, right? Counter trend rally. Yeah.
We're short the dollar index. We gave a major sell signal last May, so a year ago, at 99.
Okay.
It dropped down to close to 88. It's rallied back to 94.06 yesterday, and as far as I'm concerned, it's a counter trend rally. Everybody's now turned bullish on the dollar. A lot of shorts who were maybe particularly positioned late in the downtrend got hurt by this rally. They didn't sell at 99, they sold at 92 or something, and therefore they got pinched. And that's what happens. That's how counter trend rallies occur. That's why they occur, to clean the market out so it can go lower. And I think the dollar index rally just might have seen its peak yesterday.
Interesting.
I've got some reasons for
all
that,
right.
And I won't go into the details. But if it has, then that will obviously help the gold turnaround, which is already underway, the turnaround from the recent break. Which, by the way, silver did not participate in.
Right.
Gold went down and took out the lows since January by a percent or so, just enough to stop a lot of people out. Silver did not do that. And I don't think anybody noticed that.
Regarding gold, do you think we've once again escaped your go-to-neutral level, or is it too early to tell?
Yeah, my go-to-neutrals, I wiped them out the other day. I said originally said if you close a month at 1290 or lower, which we've not done, of course, at this point, monthly close. I looked at a lot of other indicators that I maintain, and it says, no, that's not a good number. And I said, I will update that if I think we need to have a number like that, a protective number below. But I frankly think the turn is already underway. I think the dollar surge yesterday that hit a certain number that I like to see hit, and now the downturn from that, gold immediately flipped back up, and I think gold goes, if gold, put it this way, gold's in the low 1290s, you get above 1300 again, I think you're going to zap it right back up into that range again. Range has been in, 13 to 1350 area.
Yeah, and I know that you give your subscribers definite numbers at different times as time goes on, what they should be looking at, and that's one of the reasons I just love getting your work every day to keep sort of help me keep my feet on the ground with regard to, because boy, it's awfully easy to get discouraged if you're long and you see gold dipping below 1300, you say uh-oh, here we go again, and no, but that's sort of confidence in the structure, the momentum and structure, which I think is so important. That's what's unique about your work and your own proprietary work. Michael, I want to thank you again for being with us. I know
thank
that so we're really looking forward to having you back again next week. Thank you so much. Well, folks, don't go away. We're going to have David McElvaney with us right after the commercial break, and he's going to talk to us about some really important issues, very much related to what Michael and I were just talking about, but more from a fundamental point of view. We'll be talking to David McElvaney then. Until then, okay, we'll see you right after the break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Karratha region of Western Australia, where they are currently drilling and trenching their Perdies Reward Project. In addition, Novo has partnered with Sumitomo Mining Corporation to advance its Beaton's Creek Gold Project toward production. With over $70 million in cash and strong shareholder support from the likes of Kirkland Lake Gold, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again David McElvaney. David, he's been with us two or three times at least on this show over the years. He is the president of the McElvaney Financial Companies, McElvaney Wealth Management, and ICA. That's a precious metals brokerage firm. David is a featured speaker on radio and around the country as he analyzes events, current events, and he has a very, very interesting weekly podcast that I highly recommend that you should listen to. It's very entertaining and it's also very informative. He has a very impressive academic background, but he also has spent time in the financial world with the big guys, with the mainstream, Morgan Stanley. He worked there for a little while. But unlike most younger folks these days, he has avoided being trapped into a box of Keynesian orthodoxy, which is in the process of, I think, leading the United States and indeed the world down a path towards socialism and economic destruction. I remember David's father, his work as an advocate of honest money back in the 1980s, and I actually heard him speak one time in New York at a gold mining conference, perhaps in the mid-80s. David was handed the McElvaney business baton from his father, and he is running an admirable race, I would say, for the good of his family and for all those lives that he touches. While the McElvaney business has to do with investing and using gold to preserve wealth and other markets to try to help people preserve their wealth, he is anything but a hard-hearted, cutthroat Wall Street type. To the contrary, David lives by principles given to us by our transcendent creator. And it shows through when you get to know him. Now, most of us won't have a chance to meet up with David personally, although I believe he does speak at some conferences from time to time. But you can learn to know the heart and soul of David McElvaney, and I strongly suggest you should want to do so. You can learn to know David better by reading a book that he authored a couple of years back titled The Intentional Legacy. To give you an idea of what David is all about, let me just read a short excerpt from the introduction of his book, of that book. David says, every choice we make will shape the destiny of the children yet to be born. Every act of love or hatred, redemption or savagery, thoughtfulness or selfishness births a future for ourselves and others. We live lives permeated by legacy, the legacy given to us and the legacy we cultivate every waking moment of the day. We are the custodians of a generational story. Ours is but one chapter positioned somewhere in the index of a book of indiscernible length. The narrative began long ago before we were born. It continues further into the future than we might imagine. We may not do with our lives whatever we choose. There is a higher call. We are the trustee caretakers of our great-grandchildren's future. Well, there's much more in this book, but this will give you just a flavor of what David is about. I don't know too many Wall Street guys, Wall Street professionals who have done extremely well, as David has, who are that deep, who think in terms of the eternal and things that are much more important than themselves. So with that, thank you so much, David, for joining us again.
Oh, well, Jake, great to be with you. Appreciate your kind introduction.
Well, it is a heartfelt introduction. It is that book was an encouragement to me. I just really highly recommend it. And I guess they can pick up a copy through. Can they get it from your website, or where can they go to get it? Is it available in bookstores?
Probably the easiest place to get it is on Amazon.
Sure. Okay. So, David, I'd like to talk to you about the credit cycle a little bit today, and where you think we are in the credit cycle. I have Alistair McLeod is a, I don't know if you know Alistair, but he's a guest on this show from time to time, and he's talked about where he thinks we are in the credit cycle. You know, we see the rates rising now. At this point in time, banks are selling their treasuries to avoid losses. They forget about the losses that they experienced in the last downturn, so they start putting that money to work by making loans. Money actually gets into the real economy. Consumer prices and wages begin to rise. At some point, rising rates begin to weigh on stocks. We get a bear market develops in stocks, and the next recession occurs. And then the Fed comes to the rescue and starts another cycle again. Now, where do you think we are in this cycle? Do you think we're in the late stage of this current cycle that started after 2008, 2009?
Well, I think coming back to the Treasury market, you're talking about a cycle which is very long in the tooth. Luis Yamada, who's a technical analyst, was originally with Smith Barney and spent 20, 30 years before they shut down their entire technical department, did some great work on the Treasury markets back in 2001, 2002, and what they sketched out was that the shortest interest rate cycle in the United States was a 22-year cycle. The longest was about 36, and the average, you know, somewhere in between, 27, 28 years on average. So we are here in an interest rate cycle that has started in 1982 in our 36th year, and we're matching the longest ever interest rate cycle. Arguably, we could have turned earlier had it not been for central bank intervention. And there's implications for that, of course, because as you begin to tinker with the cost of capital, that is interest rates, you do have an impact on real estate values, obviously bond values, and very importantly, interest rates are the most critical factor in valuing stocks. So if you want to raise the value of the stock market, create a wealth effect, this is what we've been experimenting with post 2008, 2009, is monetary policy on steroids, which has extended, I think, a secular treasury bull market longer than it should have gone. And that kind of means we don't have much left. We really don't have much left. But it also suggests that the tailwinds that we've had for real estate and equities may be lost here as well.
Yeah, it certainly has been a tailwind, that's for sure. So can there be another one? I mean, the 36-year Treasury bull. So, in other words, I think you've answered my question. You think this is probably about it for this bull market? I mean, I can remember Mrs. Taylor and I. Our first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage in 1981 here in New York City. And we weren't allowed to prepay the thing. You know, I mean, they wouldn't allow us to prepay it for 4 years or something like that. Do you see, I mean, how is this thing going to play out, though, when this thing comes to an end? We've had David Stockman on this show to remind us that, you know, the Fed is taking out something like $600 billion. It's pulling money out of the system. And Trump is running a $1.2 trillion deficit next year. Is the answer higher rates in order to, you know, to meet this demand? And how much can this economy take in the way of higher rates? I mean, if we get a 4% rate, can the stock market take that? And what's going to happen to pension funds and a lot of other people that have their money and everything wrapped up in the stock market?
I think we're looking at one of the great epic battles in the history of finance, and it's unfolding right in front of us. It is the battle between centralized control and command and control dynamics and what we refer to as the free markets. And, you know, rates have been rising about 18 months, 16 to 18 months longer than the Treasury's been moving. So they not only started later, the Fed started later, but they're playing catch up and are very much behind the curve. To assume that the Fed is in charge here, that I think is a little bit like, I mean, if you remember The Wizard of Oz, he wanted people to believe that he was in control of everything. So, you know, he pulled the levers and there was lots of smoke and lots of flames. And the great and mighty Oz was actually a very small man standing behind a screen from, you know, he came from running a county fair in somewhere in Texas. No, I'm sorry, not Texas, Kansas. You know, so that's the impression that they need. The market is in control at this point. The question is, how much more will the central bank community begin to throw at the market in a real bare-knuckle fight? And I think we've already seen the groundwork laid for that. Some of the analytical framework and some of the intellectual work, which had to be done sort of at the ivory tower level, has already been done. We've had some experiments in Scandinavia where complete control of the economy, cashless society, and the ability to increase taxes at will on a completely captive audience, that has already been explored. So you're talking about Michael Woodford's work, Interest in Prices, and you're talking about Ken Rogoff and his suggestion of getting completely rid of cash because it's such a dirty, nasty thing. The reality is they need to be able to control the financial system and the banking system in order to assign losses. And again, this is where I think you're looking at an epic battle between the markets determining where rates should be and the powers that be trying to keep a lid on those rates, because frankly, we can't take it. We can't take it. $262 billion is the net interest margin today, or net interest on the national debt, I should say, from 196 8 years ago, and it's set to rise with a rise in rates. To the point where it's too large a percentage of our total tax take. A single line item that say 15 or 20% becomes a critical variable in sort of the stability of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. Treasury market, and I think we're marching towards that.
So let's think through this. How does this work out? If are you suggesting the cashless society that's definitely what they have in plan? They have planned for us. I think they also have bail-ins planned. The next time there's a financial crisis, it won't be bailouts. It will be bail-ins, so that they'll just simply take some of our some of the deposits that we have in the banks. They just take it away from us and or give us capital, or give us stock or whatever in exchange for it. Is that your understanding of what they have planned? And then if that's the case, people will want to pull their money out of the banks. But if you can't pull it out and you have to leave it in digits, they've got you, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, so in the book, The Intentional Legacy, I'm talking about choices, and I'm talking about a curatorial work that relates to family dynamics, really. But at the core of that, it's still at the core of what I think needs to be as a part of our financial system, which is freedom of choice. You know, when you're talking about the value of agency and the value of autonomy and the value of privacy to make the decisions that you want to make because of your value system, these are the things that birth our future. These are the things that as individuals dignify us. Our choices allow us to demonstrate what our values are. Now, that is in direct opposition to sort of what we have today, a governmental leviathan that wants us to go along to get along. And you know, we've come to the end of being able to afford the size government that we have, but that does not mean the government has any intention of sort of shrinking itself. No. What they're doing in response is saying, away with autonomy, away with choice, away with agency. We have a one-size-fits-all solution, and if that means greater control in the financial markets, so be it. But you will choose option A, option B, and option C. That may be, again, U.S. Treasury option, a U.S. stock market option, and I don't know what option C will be, but I can guarantee you it's not going to be gold.
It's not going to be gold. Are they going to take our gold from us?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a real concern because there is a philosophical opposition. This is one of those things that has allowed for privacy, autonomy, choice, and agency through the decades and through the millennia, and it's allowed for wealth to be moved across borders. Not because that's nefarious or illegal or criminal, but if you look at the history of mankind, there is a lot of criminal activity that takes place in the halls of government, and individuals, if they don't want to be squashed by that criminality, sometimes have to step outside of their normal routines, which may include migration, which may include a whole host of things. Gold gives you real estate that you can put in your pocket. It gives you the ability to take a financial asset which is completely outside of the financial system and maintain your ability to choose and to do well.
Yeah, but again, police states are not, what you're really talking about, David, is slavery, enslavement. It's an enslavement of the system that is in place right now. And so I guess now I would like to ask you, I know that you give a great deal of thought as to how you and your family and the people that you serve can protect themselves against what is inevitably coming our way. I know that the powers that be don't want people are not shining the light on the dynamics that's happening and what's taking place. It's always people, we always have the cheerleaders on television to assure us that everything is okay. But you do a lot of work in that regard, and I would like to ask you about on your website. You have a publication called Gold and the Third Wave: What You Need to Know. Talk to us about that, because first of all, what do you mean by the third wave? And that implies a first and a second wave. Talk to us about the three waves. We're in the third wave, I gather, from your paper. And just talk to us about that report. And I think you indicated, well, I know it's available on your website because I saw it there. But talk to us about that report.
Well, I mean, one last note, because this struggle is not a new struggle in terms of the individual rights versus collective mandate. You go back to James Madison, and he said, since the civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachment of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. I mean, this is the story of all of history, and I think that's where we need to be aware of human nature and where power goes. As Acton used to say, Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the piece that you're talking about, Gold in the Third Wave, is a special report that we put together this year. Call it a look backwards and a look forwards. The base case is that we are an under-reserved country. Households are under-reserved. You look at the average household unable to handle even a $400 crisis without going into debt to do so. And you realize that, you know, close to 50% of the population in the United States is living either at the poverty level or at a level that doesn't even allow them to cover their basic needs. We can survive almost anything. We can thrive through almost any circumstances if we have adequate reserves. This applies relationally. I mean, if you go through a rough patch in your marriage, but you've made plenty of deposits to the love bank, guess what? There is an ability to endure because of the reserves. Now, if you're under-reserved and you go to a negative credit balance, this is the demise of many a relationship. I think the same is true of nations as well, where if you under-reserve, when you come to a particular crisis, whether it is an economic crisis or a political or a geopolitical crisis, it can be tragic and terminal, and it didn't have to be. So are we adequately reserved? That's a big question, and one that we deal with in gold in the third wave. Now, I look at gold and silver as the ultimate reserve assets because they do stand both inside the financial markets and outside the financial markets in a world that is permeated with layers upon layers of liabilities. I appreciate one asset that is not anyone's liability. So we see gold moving in three waves. We had the first wave of growth beginning in the early 2000s, and gold quietly began a bull market. It ran from the doldrums there in the 200s up to $1,930 an ounce, so about a 7.6-fold rise. And you know what happened in that time frame was actually both the first wave where it emerged and ultimately the second wave, where Wall Street began to take an interest. And this is very typical of any bull market. Any major bull market, whether it's Japanese equities or real estate or what have you, it's noted by mavericks who are first in, contrarians who see something that they believe to be true and are willing to put risk capital at risk. Then Wall Street, after seeing a price trend established, begins to take an interest and realize that they might be able to line their pockets if and when the general public ever comes into the same kind of thematic. So Wall Street creates its structures. What we had circa 2006 to 2009 was a mass proliferation of products, exchange-traded products, and you know, mining share, mutual funds. Yeah, exactly. All of these proliferated. You went from just a handful, say a dozen or so, to having hundreds of choices. This is Wall Street's way of ultimately capturing the flows of capital coming from Main Street. Now, the third wave is when the general public begins to really get interested. And I think we were on the cusp of that back in 2011 and 2012. The gold markets were violently shut down. And I think basically we've been on hiatus in this period of time where a long-term secular trend in gold was paused, but none of the fundamental reasons that were driving the gold market circa 2000 to 2012 have gone away. In fact, they've all mushroomed out of control. You look, for example, at the emerging markets. In the last 8 years, since the global financial crisis, emerging market debt has gone from $5 trillion to $17 trillion. I mean, this is amazing when you consider that these are emerging markets. Many of them are borrowing in U.S. dollar terms, which immediately sets them up for catastrophic cross-border financial problems. Where do you see all of the defaults in the history of the bond market? It's when people are financing themselves in foreign currency terms, and ultimately the hurdle to repay those debts becomes too high, and they must default. So we have a ticking time bomb there. It's not as if $5 trillion was a trivial amount, but now we've added exponentially to that. Of course, we've nearly doubled our gross total debt here in the United States as well. All that to say, the fundamentals are still there, supportive of the market. What went away was an interest in gold because there was apparently no reason, circa 2012 and beyond, to have an insurance policy, to have something which was outside of the financial system. Faith was restored by the creativity of Mario Draghi and of Ben Bernanke and of Mr. Kuroda. So you had faith restored, which is why gold went on hiatus. I think you're looking at the emergence of the third wave, where we begin to see a certain degree of pessimism, a certain degree of skepticism and doubt about the veracity of the tools used and the effectiveness ultimately of jump-starting the global economy and putting it on a long-term sustainable trend. We've had 9 years of growth. I think it would be normal to see a correction in the stock market at this point, but underpinning that stock market correction is a very frail financial system. One of our colleagues, Doug Noland, points this out every week on his weekly blog. I would encourage anyone who's interested, you can go to our website and look at the Credit Bubble Bulletin. And, you know, again, the fragilities in the financial system are off the charts.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately you are talking about global demand for gold exploding. It's been consistent in China and India. And that has, throughout this period, has not changed at all. Europeans are moving back into the gold market. The surprise buyer of 2017, if you're looking at exchange-traded products, was the Europeans. And so the investment segment there in gold was very strong in Europe. And you say, well, why? Why would they be buying gold if all is healthy in the Eurozone? Well, Jay, you and I both know that all is not well in the Eurozone.
Yeah,
so add to this the consequences of tightening credit globally, and I think you have what is the perfect setup for gold going to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce. That assumes a relatively stable dollar. You could see higher prices, of course, with an unstable currency environment, but I think $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce is where we go in gold's third wave. And if anyone's interested in that report, You can get it at goldthirdwave.com. There's a link there. You can request that special report, goldthirdwave.com.
And people can get on your mailing list to learn about the topics of your weekly podcast as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, and again, if you just wanted to go to goldthirdwave.com, that would be the easiest way to request the report. And if you additionally want to be added to our weekly commentary, where we've got some interesting guests periodically, and then the rest of the time you just have to put up with us. It's been a weekly labor of love for 10 years.
Absolutely it is. David, with 30 seconds, you do also have some sort of you have products that allow gold to be put into IRAs, right?
Yeah, we're actually the first company in the United States to put physical metals into IRAs going back to the mid to late 80s. And that is a very useful tool.
Okay.
We want to help people preserve assets. We want to help people think well and choose wisely.
All right. I hope our listeners will avail themselves to David's work, his team, Doug Nolan there. I've known him for many years, back in the days with David Tice and the Prudent Bear Fund. Thank you so much, David, for being with us again. It's always a pleasure to have you, and all the best. Take care.
Thank you, Jake. Great to be with
folks,
you again.
Thank you. Folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, John Rubino will be here. Michael Oliver will be back again, and Michael Adams of Northern Empire. will be my guest next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its seven premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit AurenResources.com.